ready to hear argument in the case of Heartland Lakeside School District against WEA Insurance.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chief Judge Easterbrook. Sorry, force of habit. May it please the court. The early retiree reinsurance program passed by Congress was targeted at employment-based plans like those maintained by my client school districts and by the class. As the record reflects, each of these named districts, the representative districts, had claims that were subject to reimbursement of considerable size, $500,000 to $750,000 apiece over a couple of years. This congressional program was intended to reimburse the districts which had paid for these claims out of monies as part of the stimulus program to bridge the gap until the Affordable Care Act was to kick in.
Counsel, before you get into the substance, on the question of jurisdiction, and I know this was briefed on the removal issue, do you have any new cases to support your argument that the court lacks jurisdiction over this?
Only one, but it's a good one, Gunn versus Minton. Gunn versus Minton by the Supreme Court last year, which has been decided since this court declined to hear the 1292B appeal. And Gunn versus Minton, building on what the Supreme Court had said in Empire Healthcare, said, talking about the three elements that have been, or the four elements that have been identified as necessary before an embedded federal question in a state law claim can give rise to 1331 jurisdiction, emphasize the importance of the third element of substantiality and what is meant by that has to be a substantial federal question. And it said this was a case in which the Texas Supreme Court had decided that lawyer malpractice cases involving patent claims could only be brought in federal court and dismissed a state court case, went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in a unanimous opinion, Chief Justice Roberts, expanding on Grable and Empire Healthcare, said the substantiality inquiry under Grable looks to the importance of the issue to the federal system as a whole, not to the importance of the issues to the parties. The federal issue is obviously important to the parties because the first two steps are that it has to be a federal issue, it has to be a necessary federal issue. There is a federal issue in this case, there isn't any question, and that is the interpretation of who is a plan sponsor, what is a plan, who's entitled to get this money. But the claim is a tort claim. It's a series of state tort law claims trying to deal with the fact that this money was intended.
Let me ask you the reverse of Judge St. Eve's question. Are you aware, I'll ask this same question to Mr. DiTullio, are you aware of any case by any other circuit holding that litigation of this sort properly is in federal court?
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
I certainly searched and could not find any.
Yeah. There are
the magistrate judge did not mention Gunn, although the magistrate judge's jurisdictional decision postdates Gunn.
I don't think so, Your Honor. Magistrate judge's jurisdictional decision was in 2012.
Oh, is that right?
That's right. 2012? This was here 2 years
ago. Gunn is February 2013.
Right. Yeah, this was here 2 years ago this month. We haven't appealed on that. We've been through and we're done and we're ready to try to persuade the court that the district court was wrong on the merits. We aren't particularly anxious to go to state court and start over, but we recognize that if the court doesn't...
Yes, I know you're not particularly anxious to start over, but we do need to start with our own jurisdiction. And I must say, given Gunn, that the district court's decision, which boils down to a claim that any time there's a good federal defense, then it can be removed,
right,
is awfully hard to square with the Supreme Court. So I do think we need this issue briefed and fully by both sides.
Happy to do it.
How about 21 days for full briefs on subject matter jurisdiction?
That'll be fine, Your Honor. We'll be happy to do that. Anyway, we get back to it. What I think is the claims that we brought because of what the WEA Trust did, the money that was intended by Congress to reimburse for those claims, the claims attributable to my client's employees, you know, teachers, janitors, administrators, some of them members of the teachers' union, some of them members of other unions, some of them not members of unions at all, they ended up in the hands not of the districts that they were intended to go to, the districts that paid the claims, the districts that were to put that money back into maintaining retiree health system plans, but it ended up in the hands of our former insurance company, which insisted on keeping it and using it for its own business purposes. Its own business purposes being to offer discounts to people who would, notwithstanding the fact that its premiums were higher, stay with it. The conduct by which WEA Trust got the money intended for for the districts is tortious under Wisconsin law. It amounts to conversion, and because it amounts to conversion and because the relationship was a business relationship, it also violates our civil theft statute, which has mandatory multiple damages, exemplary damages provisions and attorney's fee provisions. And it's also violative of tort law in the sense of being giving rise to an unjust enrichment claim. They've got money they shouldn't have, and then an equity they shouldn't be able to retain. And finally, it is subject to a claim for breach of fiduciary duty. WEA Trust...
The thrust of your argument, and the district court said this too, is that you were challenging DHHS's decision in the first place to award these funds to the trust. If that's the case, do you need to sue DHHS and use the Administrative Procedures Act to do so?
Your Honor, I don't know whether we have an Administrative Procedure Act claim or not. Failure to exhaust administrative remedies has never been pleaded by WEA Trust as a defense in this case. I don't think it is a defense. Under the facts of this case, the facts of this case are that having told the districts in a mass mailing that it had applied for these monies on its behalf, on their behalf, and would get it for them, WEA Trust, as we learned only after the litigation began, when we finally saw the application it had submitted to DHHS, applied in its own name, listing its own insurance policies as the plan and itself as the plan sponsor. We didn't know that. We didn't know that until after the fact.
Is there any evidence in the record that the agency did anything to verify this information or confirm that they qualified as a plan sponsor, or did they just take the information at face value that they were
There is deposition testimony from the gentleman who was responsible for this, the general counsel, to the effect that there was no communication between WEA Trust and the Department of Health and Human Services other than the application itself. The application falsely stated that WEA Trust was the plan and the plan sponsor, and using the claims data from our clients, employees, got the money. Did DHHS do something wrong? I don't think so. They were lied to, in fact, and they got, you know, they paid out the money, and they've got the money in their hands. So, could there be a remedy in front of the DHHS? Maybe. I'm frankly not particularly interested in that. I'm interested in the fact that the money that was intended for the school districts ended up in the hands of their former insurance company, which won't cough it up. This gets back, the district, the WEA Trust has claimed throughout this, and it's the basis for its application to DHHS, that it is a plan. And it isn't. It simply isn't a plan under ERISA. It's not an employee welfare benefit plan. That's been established for 30 years by precedent binding on WEA Trust from the Eighth Circuit, which held that the WEA Trust is not a plan. They tried this at the beginning of ERISA in order to claim exemption from state insurance regulation. The Iowa regulators went after them, said that you are not a plan, and the Eighth Circuit held it is not a plan.
What about their argument that they're a VEBA, which I don't think there's a dispute on, and therefore they qualify under 18002 Section A2B?
They are a VEBA. which is to say they're a 501c9 exempt, tax-exempt organization. That's a tax term. They are a VEBA. We are a school district. We are an employer. A VEBA is an entity that can be a plan sponsor. It can be a VEBA can have a plan. This particular plan, the WEA Trust, is not an ERISA plan. It could have one. A VEBA could have one. It is a type of entity. It describes a number of entities that could be plan sponsors. But as a matter of fact, WEA Trust does not offer an ERISA plan. The plans are the district's plans. There are 100, and for my client's sake, 150 of these plans. Each district offers its own plan. Each district commits itself to its own employees of what benefits it's going to get. And it takes care of that as the ERP, I'm sorry to use that word, that's what it's called, the ERP statute says this could be either an insured plan or a self-funded plan. And these plans are insured plans. We bought the insurance from WEA Trust, and it used its access to the information and its trusted relationship with the districts to persuade the districts that it would act on their behalf to get the money, and then it kept it. It's as simple as that. It's a pretty straightforward tort claim, and I don't think the essential terms are contested other than the contest about whether or not WEA Trust is a plan. But I think, as I say, that issue was litigated long ago and they've lost, and I still don't understand their theory that they could be a plan. Congress wanted to get this money out. It didn't want to put it into the coffers of insurance companies so that they could offer rebates to their customers. It wanted the money spent. The money sitting in an account right now, we haven't had the opportunity to spend it. We recognize that if we got it, we would need to spend it on our plans. But we didn't get to that point, and so that's why we're here.
How do you get around the regulation at 423 that says a plan can be a group health plan can be a plan under ERISA, which I understand your argument that the Department of Labor and the Eighth Circuit already decided that, but it goes on to say that they also include the following plans. And the trust is arguing that they qualify under the collective bargaining plan, an ERISA plan.
First of all, there is no collective bargaining agreement that creates the WEA trust plan. Secondly, what DHHS meant in 423.882 is fully explained in the excerpt from the Federal Register that's included in our supplemental reproduction of statutes and regulations on page 39, the Federal Register, page 4402 for January 28, 2005, in which it explains how that language got in there. And how it got in there was sort of a belt and suspenders effort on behalf of the agency. Entities like, and there are some collectively bargained plans, WEA Trust doesn't have one, but entities like school districts, governmental plans, they operate plans which fit the definition of ERISA plans, and they are employee welfare benefit plans, but they're not subject to ERISA regulation. They're exempted from ERISA regulation. So a government plan is an ERISA plan, but it isn't subject to ERISA regulation. And entities like that, church plans is another whole group of them, this is explained in the Federal Register, were concerned that someone would think they weren't entitled to, in this case, the retiree drug subsidy money that was being passed out in 2005, the regulations that were taken over into the ERP regulations. And the agency explains we wanted to make sure that it was clear that they are included among those who are entitled to this reimbursement, as the agency says in the middle of the page, 39, provided they meet the definition of group health plan in ERISA section 6071. So you still have to have a plan. You can't be a provider of a commodity insurance and show up and take money that belongs to the entity which is actually providing health benefits to retirees. So we really think it's that straightforward. Judge Callahan seemed to think that the law was. He cites the this court's Citizens Health decision of about a year ago, which I don't, we've explained in the brief why we don't think that really says what he thought it said, that somehow if you get money from the federal government, you get to keep it under any circumstances. And that isn't the law. It isn't the law in this case. You still have to be entitled to it. And if you get money that belonged to somebody else, you're subject to being sued by the person whose money it is to get it back, and sued in state court on a tort claim. And so
you're in your rebuttal, Mr. Schreiner.
All right. Well, I'll sit down. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiner. Mr. DiTullio.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Stephen DiTullio. I'm one of the attorneys representing the appellees in the present action before the Court this morning. Before I get into answering some of the points brought up by the District's Counsel this morning, I want to emphasize there are five reasons this Court should affirm the District Court in this action. First, the Trust did apply for the ERB funds with its own credentials, not that of the District's. And the DHHS evaluated the trust application and approved it. Second, as this court held in Citizens Health last year, federal funds belong to the party that applied for and received them. In other words, the trust owns the ERP funds. Third, all ERP funds received by the trust, all of them, will be used to reduce future coverage costs related to the trust plan. This is wholly consistent with ERP. None of the funds will be retained by the trust. Fourth, the trust use of the ERP funds is consistent with the public policy under ERP of ensuring continued health insurance coverage for retirees. Finally, the districts could have benefited from the trust's ERP funds, and they could have received the credits if they had simply stayed with the trust. They chose not to, despite, even before the trust applied for the funds, information was given to the districts indicating that to participate in the ERP funds, they needed to maintain participation with the trust. Now, the districts have maintained, both in the briefs and this morning, that the trust is an insurance company. I just want to clarify that. The trust is not an insurance company. The districts are wrong in that presentation. The district's arguments reflect that they don't totally understand the purpose and the differences between the two organizational defendants in this case, the WEA Trust on one hand and the WEA Insurance Corporation on the other. So what is the WEA Trust? It's clearly the entity that applied for and received and was approved for the funds in this matter. The trust is a not-for-profit entity governed by 11 trustees, each of whom was named as individual defendants in this case, and each of whom are teachers or retirees and members of teachers' unions. And very important to understand, they're also all members of the trust.
And do you concede that it is not an employee welfare benefit plan as defined by ERISA?
It is not an employee welfare benefit plan. I can see that. But that doesn't result in a finding that it doesn't have coverage under ERISA. And the reason for that is there are two parts to the applicable portion of ERISA that defines a plan for coverage. One is it could be an employee welfare benefit plan. And I do not disagree with opposing counsel at all that the Eighth Circuit found it was not an EWBP. But there is that second prong of ERISA that specifically addresses a collective bargaining entity. And that is indeed what the trust is. It was created out of unions. In its charter, it mentions the union. It's a creature from the Wisconsin Employment Association Council. And even more important, all of the benefits that are provided are the result of collective bargaining agreements, all of them. In fact, we cited in our materials, and I want to point the court to this.
But that section of ERISA that you're relying on wouldn't qualify it for a group health plan as defined in ERP, would it?
Yes, it would.
How is that? ERP limits the group health plan to the definition of ERISA's employee benefit plan.
Okay. This is how Judge Sinib, it is a bit confusing. I will grant that. So, bottom line is that under 149.2, 45 CFR 149.2, it states that an employment-based plan means a group health plan. So they're basically interchangeable terms. Moreover, the regulations establish that the districts are wrong in regard to their argument that the trust is not a group health plan for two reasons. First, as I mentioned, it doesn't need to be an EWBP. It can be a collective bargaining plan to be a group health plan.
But are you relying on the regulations pertaining to ERP as opposed to ERISA?
Understood.
What I understood your argument to be was ERISA had this whole other definition for a collective bargaining agreement, and that would qualify. But ERISA does not, and the Eighth Circuit and the Department of Labor specifically said that your client is not an employee welfare benefit plan. It sounds to me like you are now relying on the collective bargaining plan aspect of the regulations that govern ERP, not ERISA.
No. ERP points to ERISA for definitional purposes.
Correct.
And under that definition of employment-based plan, it goes into a group health plan. That definition is sort of equivalent. And because ERP points to that definition, there are two parts to it, the employee welfare benefit plan and the collective bargaining. It doesn't have to be both. It can be either or. And our argument is that it is a collective bargain plan. And one of the reasons we believe that, directing the court to the Seventh Circuit docket number 18-1, which was cited in our brief, there's language in there that specifically says the above-named employer in this document is basically the group health insurance agreement between the districts and the trust. And it specifically says the above-named employer hereby certifies that it is eligible to participate in the WEA Insurance Trust by virtue of its collective bargaining agreement with the identified local education association and request the WEA preferred provider plan group. It goes on from there. It's clear that this did arise through collective bargaining. It's also important in looking at that document that going to the issue of whether or not the trust has a plan and whether it's a plan sponsor, at the bottom of that document specifically says the above group insurance plan is sponsored by the WEA Insurance Trust and underwritten by the WEA Insurance Corporation. Now, the chronology of that is very important here. Okay, understand that the plan didn't get developed because ERP came along. Okay, in 1970, when the trust was established as Aviva, it had in its charter a definition of a plan. In 1985, in its amendment to its plan, 1985, long before ERP, plan is specifically defined.
Every time you say ERP, I think about the U.S. Marshal of Tombstone, Arizona.
Understood.
If you could say the act or section, whatever this number is, there's always a problem when lawyers who have spent too much time on one case talk to generalist judges like us. I've never heard of ERRP before, and with luck, I will never hear of it again.
I will do my absolute best for the rest of this presentation to make sure I refer to it as the Act. I lost my train of thought there. The plan, it was established long before the Act was enacted. It's set forth in their charter that they would have a plan, and it's defined. Okay, in much the same way, the agreement that I just referenced, that agreement was signed every year, pre-ERP, as well as post-ERP.
It is very hard, isn't it?
Post-enactment, it is very difficult. It's clear that there was a plan, and the trust presented itself as a plan sponsor before the Act came into being. That's significant because this case has been characterized by the districts as sort of some sort of conspiratorial plot to hoodwink, if you will, the districts in regard to these funds. Furthest thing is from the truth.
What you're saying now, indeed much of what you've been saying, brings us back to the question about subject matter jurisdiction. Because much of what this case is about seems to concern the relations between the school district and the insurance corporation. What one said to another, what their real dealings are. None of those is a question arising under federal law. And if the claim looks like it's a claim arising under a claim of contract or a claim of false representation about, it's specific to these school districts and this insurer, rather than a claim about how much money anybody gets or whether insurers would be entitled in the first instance to be paid. Doesn't that raise a serious question about what this case is doing in federal court?
Judge Easterbrook, in regard to the jurisdictional issue, I'm pleased we'll have a chance to brief that in 21 days.
I know we'll have it briefed in 21
days. There is federal jurisdiction here. This court was correct in its initial review of that
issue.
We
did not rule on the merits.
Understood.
We decided that we would not accept an interlocutory appeal, and such a decision has no meaning at all on the merits.
Understood, Judge Easterbrook. Bottom line is each of the four state law claims that have been pled here are indeed dependent on interpretation of federal regulations and federal law.
But as I understand the plaintiff's claim, they're not dependent at all on federal law. The plaintiffs say it's all fine and dandy for WEA Insurance to accept the money, but as a matter of our dealings with them, they have to hand it over to us in one particular way, that is, immediately, rather than discounting future premiums. That seems to be a matter outside the federal regulations. You're not saying that there's any federal regulation about handing it over immediately versus discounting future premiums. And we can put to one side whether a federal defense, even if there were such a federal regulation, would create federal jurisdiction. Gunn seems to say no. Do you have any comment about Gunn, by the way?
Well, Gunn is an interesting case. I don't think it changes the Grable decision. It certainly is.
Gunn says that Grable is controlling for Grable and nobody else.
Right.
That's what Gunn says.
Right.
Whereas what the magistrate judge said here is that anytime you've got a federal defense, under Grable, anytime you've got a federal defense, you can remove. And Gunn expressly disapproved that reading of Grable.
Correct.
So if jurisdiction is going to be sustained, it has to be sustained on a ground other than the magistrate judge's. Now, is there some other federal court? This is the question I asked Mr. Schreiner and said I would ask you. Is there some other court of appeals which has said that there's federal jurisdiction when a defense is asserted under Section 1102, the Act?
I'm not aware of any judge.
We sure looked and couldn't find any.
Yep. I'm not aware of any.
Are you aware of any district court judges who have addressed that either?
I am not, Judge. I'm not.
I got one more jurisdictional question, which I hope the briefs will address. The dispute here seems to concern ownership of funds that have their root in a federal program. There are a bunch of other doctrines concerning whether there's a federal question about the ownership of things that have a federal basis. The most famous of these is copyright law. Copyright is a federal piece of intellectual property. But suppose there's a dispute about who owns the copyright. Does that arise under federal law? Judge Friendly's famous case, T.B. Harms against LSQ, held not. And we've agreed with T.B. Harms against LSQ. And the same thing has been true about patents, about trademarks. The fact that something has a genesis, that a property right has a genesis in federal law, doesn't mean that an ownership dispute about that property is a dispute under federal law. Seems to me that for us to have federal jurisdiction here, we'd have to explain, we'd either have to overrule our cases about copyright and trademark, or we'd have to explain why this particular federal property right is different from, say, a copyright. I hope the briefs will address that question.
And they certainly will, and I think it's probably going to be going down the latter path, in part because one key differentiation with this particular federal law is the fundamental purpose of this act was to ensure that retirees would continue to have access.
The fundamental purpose of copyright law is to ensure that the creators of original works get a reward. And I can imagine saying, well, we have an ownership dispute. I say I'm the owner. He says he's the owner. the federal interest in making sure the real owner gets the reward can be carried out only by deciding in federal court who the real owner is. We've considered that argument and found it wanting. Every court of appeals has found that argument wanting. I think you're hard-pressed to explain why this is different.
Okay. Thank you, Judge. In regard to the ownership of the funds, which going back to the merits for a moment, we do believe that the district court was correct in its review of ownership and finding that all four claims fail in this lawsuit because of the lack of ownership by the districts.
Does Citizens Health really help you? The court there didn't make a general proposition. The way I read it is the court was interpreting the co-agreement between the plaintiff and the defendant in that case and the terms that they had agreed to and who was going to be the grantee.
Judge Sweeney, I think it does help us in a number of ways. First of all, it clearly holds for the proposition that a court needs to give deference to the funding agency, the DHHS in this case. It also did hold that the grantee of the funds owns the funds. And here it clearly...
But it did that in connection with the underlying co-agreement. It didn't say any time a grantee applies, the funds belong to the grantee. It interpreted that grant application based on the agreement that the plaintiff and the defendant had.
The facts are different between the two cases. There was no joint effort here. In our case, it was the trust applying for the funds on its own. So that is a distinction between the two. There was a breach of contract in that case, as Your
but
Honor.
But you started out by saying that Citizens Health stands for the proposition that funds, federal funds, apply to the person or entity who applied for them. And I don't read Citizens Health as standing for that broad proposition.
Well, it did find that a federal that one party applied for the funds and received it.
Correct.
And therefore owned the funds.
But it's the therefore. They looked at the underlying co-agreement as to what the agreement between the plaintiff and the defendant said about who was the owner of the funds, which is not the case here.
That is a distinction. I agree.
So what happens on the merits, if we get to the merits, if the court's holding based on Citizens Health is wrong?
The court's holding on Citizens Health is wrong?
In other words, that was the gist of the ruling below, that ownership of the funds went to the trust, and therefore none of the claims survived on summary judgment. What if the holding based on Citizens Health falls through, what happens?
I believe that the trust still prevails in this case. Its arguments are not solely based on Citizens Health, and as the district court recognized, it is one basis, and they recognize that there are some differences between the cases, but there are other reasons that the trust should prevail in this case.
But would it be upheld here, or is that something that would have to go back to the district court to decide in the first instance, or the magistrate judge?
I think it could be upheld here, Judge. I think it could. There's enough in the record and in the judge's, in Judge Callahan's decision, the district court's decision, to allow for this court to affirm that decision by the district court. One very important aspect of the Act that does need to be focused on is the maintenance of effort aspect of it, because there is testimony in the record indicating that at least two of the districts did not maintain the health insurance benefits. And as a result of that, they could not meet the MEO requirements. That's one of the fundamental key policy issues involved in this case, is that one of the reasons that the DHHS awarded the funds to the trust in the first place is there was a finding that all of the requirements necessary, including maintenance of effort, including having procedures in place to effectively ensure that there was no waste or fraud. All of those were affirmatively met by the trust. And as a result, that decision by the department does deserve some deference. But in much the same way, the districts cannot have the IRB funds because they've already shown through testimony that they can't meet the MOE. And that is one thing that I believe this court needs to look at in regard to the substance of this case, because, again, you have to look at the underlying policy behind the act, which is to ensure that the retirees, who, by the way, all of them are members of the trust, keep that in mind. Opposing counsel oftentimes references the plan as their plan and their employees. Every single individual involved in this case where the claims were submitted are members of the trust as a view.
Thank you, Mr. DiTullio.
Thank you very much.
Anything further, Mr. Schreiner?
Yes, Your Honor.
A couple of points. First on jurisdiction, which always runs me into the risk of falling off the edge. In our 1292B petition, and of course we'll repeat it again, your questions and Judge St. Eve's questions about other cases under this statute, under the early reinsurance program, we're not aware of any ever having been brought, not only in any court of appeals, but in any district court. And as this court said in Chicago Tribune, relying on its interpretation of Grable, one of the reasons there was why they found federal jurisdiction in Grable was its resolution was dispositive of the case and would be controlling in numerous other cases. Take away those ingredients, the court said, and there is no federal jurisdiction. Yeah, so I'll take them away. Mr. Tullio mentioned that we sued the trustees. We sued them in their official capacity. Under Wisconsin law, you can't sue a trust. You have to sue trustees in their capacity as trustees. We've not sought anything personal against them. The phrase is not, as Mr. DiTullio said in the regulation that we discussed when I was up here earlier, a collective bargaining plan. It's a collectively bargained plan. And, you know, pages 12 to 15 of our reply brief go into all the minutiae why this isn't a collectively bargained plan. The plan, the WEA Trust, WEA Trust plan, is not a collectively bargained plan. It was created by a teachers union 50 years ago. It is not. We purchase insurance as a result of collecting, we used to, as a result of collective bargaining agreements with our local unions. But we could buy that insurance from anybody. We didn't have to buy it from the teachers union's trust company, insurance company. There's a document, Mr. Tullio refers to them, and up until 2011, WEA Trust was still telling all the districts with respect to certain annual certifications of credible coverage, you as the employer sponsor are responsible for the information. You as a group health sponsor must submit the disclosure form. That's us. That's not them. When they refer on this agreement that we signed every year to a plan, they're talking about insurance policies. They call it a plan. It's loose language. Your PPO, your point of service plan. We think that there isn't any jurisdiction. We've maintained that from the beginning, and if it turns out we were right, I guess we'll have to see if we can persuade the state court not to trash everything we've done over the last 2 years. But on the merits, I mean, this is just a very straightforward tort claim, the district court, I'm sorry to say, missed the boat. And we think not only should we be able to go back in front of some court, but we think we're entitled to summary judgment in our favor and a lot of money. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thanks to both counsel. The court directs parties to file briefs.